This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Heaven's Harvest. Heaven's Harvest offers a simple food plan to sustain you and your family during a crisis. Call 800-516-4773 and mention my name, Janet, to get free shipping. Or go to heavensharvest.com. That's heavensharvest.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thank you so much for joining us today. In recent years, a number of professing Christians who work in the scientific fields have tried to bridge the gap between science and God by embracing the concept of theistic evolution. Now, this is the idea that you can merge the Bible with evolution and come out with both your theological and your scientific credibility intact. But in fact, as my next guest notes, this is an impossible scenario. And as he puts it, you cannot have your God and your Darwin, too, while leaving nothing at the door. So joining us now is Dr. Wayne Rossiter. He is assistant professor of biology at Waynesburg University. And today we'll be talking about his book called Shadow of Oz, Theistic Evolution and the Absent God. It's great to have you here, Dr. Rossiter. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on.
Well, I am so glad you wrote this book because it seems to be a trend now where you have people like Francis Collins at BioLogos and a number of other Christians who say, you know, this is really the intelligent position to be a theistic evolutionist. Why do you think that this is not the great position that these guys put out there as being the reasonable one?
Yeah, I mean, you do get the feeling that there's sort of there's the smart guys in the room, and they all go for theistic evolution, and the rest of us are sort of knuckle draggers on this stuff.
Right.
Why is it not the smart position? I just find it that on both sides of the argument, both in the area of scientific inquiry, but also in the area of theology, that it has shortcomings that are irreparably damaging. That it just simply It suffers from internal contradictions, and I write about those in my book, that I don't believe it can ever escape from. I don't think that there will be a solution in the future in which suddenly the Darwinian understanding of biological systems becomes compatible with Christianity. I just don't see it, and I think most people who sort of look through that largely agree, and we can get even to where there's some admission from the theistic evolutionists on that topic.
Right.
Well, but in general, so not to interrupt you, but what I basically say is that the major problem is that you cannot be intended and unintended at the same time. And until you can solve that contradiction of being intended in the image of God, made by God for purpose, and being an accidental product of a blind process like evolution, until you can somehow merge those two, you can never have a compatible working worldview.
Yeah, that's a great summary of what is believed. So now, I know you talk about some different forms of theistic evolution, and there's some variations. But generally speaking, when somebody says, I'm a theistic evolutionist, what do they basically think about unintended versus intended creation and all of these things where we see, you know, natural selection being part of it, but also the Bible being part of it? How do they kind of merge those worldviews?
So you mentioned that there's some nuance to that. There are different views. I would say you can kind of largely group them in the two different paths. One of them would be one that is followed largely, most famously, by Ken Miller, biologist at Brown University, which is basically to go the road of open theism.
Right.
In which God isn't so concerned. First of all, he doesn't know what's going to happen exactly, and he's not really concerned with the specifics of what does unfold. So this is sort of, I don't think Polkinghorne would agree with Miller, but Polkinghorne, a physicist, has written that this understanding of reality is a universe that is allowed to create itself. Which is to say, God basically sets back, and he has this mechanism that he's created, and now the mechanism itself is just going to roll through time and produce things. And so you wouldn't have necessarily life on this planet. There's nothing special about Earth. You might not have intelligent life in the way that we understand it in the universe. It might be some other intelligent life that God would seek communion with. And so, and I joke around a little bit about this, but so the Ken Miller view, and he sort of publicly said this, not only are we not intended, but it could have been a big-brained dinosaur or a hyper-intelligent mollusk that came to to meet God. And so it's completely open is the point. The alternative to that, which is the one I think would be more like what you'd see from BioLogos, which is a big think tank for theistic evolution, would be something in which God has foreknowledge of these things, but he's still not really getting his hands messy and getting involved in that unfolding. It's still sort of unfolding of its own accord by natural processes. And God, you know, might know where it's heading, but isn't actively participating at this point. He sort of sits back and it goes. There is a third grouping within that, you could say, in which there are some who argue, Stephen Barr would be an example, that God is actually intimately involved in everything that's happening, every single event, everywhere, at all times, and that he's just controlling it in a way that we just can't detect it. So he's everywhere all the time, and he's undetectable anywhere.
Right. But this raises, as you mentioned, a number of internal contradictions, because on the one hand, you have the account in Genesis talking about, you know, what God himself says about the creation of the world and how he made it very good and Adam and Eve and all the rest. So if they are taking the position, for example, that God made the world, but through these evolutionary processes, he's kind of sitting back and allowing those natural processes to take place. Where do you find room to be able to refute that and say that can't possibly be true? You can't have one without the other. They don't go together.
Well, I think for them, it's to draw a line. They and this is something that I've sort of pushed on. This is the really when I interact with theistic evolutionists, I really want an answer to one thing. On what basis do you believe in the supernatural, miraculous Jesus? A God-man.
Yeah.
On what basis do you strongly affirm that, and then so vehemently reject all other supernatural activity that we see in the Bible? Prehistory, pre-human history, and within human history. I mean, when you start reading a lot of what they have to say, I mean, you know, John Hott says that we look in vain for divine activity, direct divine intervention in natural history and in human history.
Wow.
So basically, a lot of things sort of get shelved very quickly. And that I think that is, I don't want to accuse them of being sort of intentionally dishonest with it, but I think there's a sort of Trojan horse in there.
Yeah.
I think there's this idea that you mentioned him earlier, like a guy like Francis Collins, that, well, you know, Francis Collins is this really great biologist, and he also is a, you know, devout Christian, and so therefore you must be able to have evolution and Christianity too. And the question simply becomes, well, what does that Christianity look like when you're done with it?
There it is. Yeah.
And so when you actually start to unpack what it looks like, I find it unrecognizable as Christianity. And actually, Collins, to some degree, if you read his book, Language of God, distances himself from the idea of petitionary prayer and God's activity and his role in intervening today.
Oh, wow.
So you'd only lose the miracles of the past. You start losing the ability to actually have a God who is listening and answering today.
Right. Well, and don't you have to do violence to the Bible to create a God like that? That's not the God who's revealed in the Bible. The God who's revealed in the Bible is intimately involved with his creation.
Right. Well, that gets back to this idea of, I think Jesus represents the you know, proverbial stumbling block for them.
Yeah.
To justify why that. But even within that, so, okay, fine. You know, all of them affirm Jesus. Now, what do you affirm? But they don't affirm angels.
Hmm.
Right? Well, Jesus interacts, you know, with spiritual beings.
Yeah.
He affirms them. Everybody around him affirms them. If you read the New Testament, you don't have to go to the Old Testament. I don't like when people get drugged down into this discussion of the Genesis 1.
Right.
That's a place to start, but there are other places where this really comes to a head. And one of those is you've got a Jesus who was born of a virgin, working miracles, rose from the dead, and is God nature, and yet they don't even really want to have all the stuff around that. From cover to cover, the Bible is full of God directly intervening and interacting with his people.
Yeah. And an angel announced the birth of Christ, for crying out loud.
Well, and the angels are there when they go look for him in the tomb.
Yes,
and,
right.
you know.
He's
so,
not here.
Well, and guys like Carl Giberson, who is another one of the founding members of BioLogos, I mean, he mocked Norm Geisler for believing in demons.
Oh, wow.
To mock Norm Geisler for believing in demons is to mock Jesus. He talked to them.
Of course. Of course. I mean, what a great point. Well, there's a lot more to discuss. We'll do it with Dr. Wayne Rossiter when we return his book, Shadow of Oz, Theistic Evolution and the Absent God. Stay with us on Janet Mefford Today. So you've missed the healthcare deadline and don't have any form of healthcare? Liberty HealthShare has the answer. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry that offers an affordable healthcare option, allowing you to enroll any time of the year. Liberty HealthShare allows you to control, manage, and direct your healthcare, yet still be in good standing with the Affordable Care Act. Members are exempt from the tax penalty and mandates imposed on individuals for not having healthcare insurance, thus giving you freedom from insurance. Liberty HealthShare gives you the ability to choose any doctor or hospital across the nation. Memberships are for individuals, couples, and families, offering a variety of options to best suit your medical needs. If you're a freedom-loving American looking for contract-free health care, then Liberty HealthShare is for you. For more information on how to enroll at any time of the year, call now 855-585-4237. That's 855-585-4237. Or visit libertyhealthshare.org to request a free estimate. That's libertyhealthshare.org.
All have sinned. This is Ken Ham, and I'm inviting you to visit our full-size Noah's Ark near Cincinnati. How do we lovingly witness to homosexuals or transgender individuals? Well, start by showing them that God is the creator of the universe, marriage, and gender. And because he's the creator, only he has the right to set the rules. But Adam disobeyed God, and since then we've all broken God's commandments. Scripture says that all have sinned and that no one is righteous. That's the bad news. But the good news is that Jesus came and died in our place. He took our penalty by dying on the cross, and he defeated death by rising from the dead. Now he freely offers forgiveness and eternal life to all of those who believe.
You can sign up for free daily insights from Ken Ham when you visit AnswersRadio.com. You can also view a transcript of this program at AnswersRadio.com.
We're back on Janet Mefford Today. My guest, Dr. Wayne Rossiter, he is assistant professor of biology at Waynesburg University and has written a great book. It is called Shadow of Oz, Theistic Evolution and the Absent God. Now, we were talking before we went to the break, Dr. Rossiter, about some of the assumptions of the theistic evolutionist. This seems to be such a cool position to take. It's very trendy. I can merge my scientific acumen with my biblical worldview. But you know what I thought was so interesting, what you said in the book? You've said that the trend of these theistic evolutionists is to sacrifice God at the altar of Darwin, but never the other way around. I found that fascinating, and I wanted to kind of find out from you how they do that, how you have seen them do that.
Well, I think we've discussed a little bit about that before the break, but in general, what you have is a loyalty to having a naturalistic, which basically means a non-divine, non-supernatural understanding of all unfolding of happenings.
Yeah.
So that's a fancy way of basically saying God's not really doing anything directly. So you're sort of removing him from the activity of being engaged in our history. And in place of that, every time, the reason that we vacate those areas is because we believe that science forces us to.
Right.
And particularly Darwin. Darwin, you know, a lot of what's become a very popular quote recently is a guy, Aubrey Moore, who was a contemporary of Darwin, who sort of saw what Darwin's thesis held and then said, well, he's thrown down the gauntlet. Basically, we have a choice. Either God is nowhere or God is everywhere. And what he meant by that is Darwin has shown us that we're not going to find God's fingerprints on anything.
Wow.
And so our only last resort is to vacate everything and then say God's involved in ways that can't be detected.
Wow.
And so effectively, that's sort of the game that's being played in large parts. Now, if you read a lot of the literature, they will at least say that they believe miracles are possible and these sorts of things. But they'll never tell you which ones from the Bible or from present day. And some of them actually do reject them outright. Pierre Teilhard was one of them that basically said, you know, a miracle is basically something we just haven't explained yet, and when we do, it won't be a miracle.
Yeah.
So basically, yeah, there's a sacrificing of God's being, and you get it. It's reworded in a way that sounds more intelligent. So what they'll say is that it's actually the absurd view to think that God would have a faulty creation that needs to be fixed by him. That somehow it wasn't set up correctly to begin with, and so he's got to stick his fingers in here and there to fix things.
Wow.
And so that to a young student in high school or college, that might sound sort of reasonable, like, well, yeah, of course, because that would suggest that he was imperfect in his ability to create. And so they'll reword it in such a way that it seems like they have the high ground. But effectively, what you've done is actually greatly limit the God you're talking about, because now you have a God who can't break his own rules.
Good grief.
And I use an analogy of this because I think it's very fitting. My grandfather at one point in time owned several gas stations, but used to work at one of those. And I've already given sort of away the story, but it sort of makes my point. He worked as a janitor. He would stock, you know, beverages and clean out the trash cans and work the toilets and sweep the parking lot. And his friends start to think maybe he was, you know, coming on hard times. And so, of course, they finally asked him about it. And he said, well, you know, are you really that hard up for money? And he says, no, I own the place.
Right.
And I think that's sort of what we have in God, is a God who reigns from on high. He owns the place. But he's a God who is sitting beside us sharing our meal. Right. That's the Jesus we understand. That's the God of the Old Testament. He's there.
Yes.
And so I actually think that while it might sound better to say that God was so good, Dennis Lemieux says it this way. He says God was so good that he's like a billiards player who on the first strike, all the balls go down in order. Right. He just, once he starts it, it's so good that he doesn't have to do anything else. That's actually not the God of the Bible.
No.
So I think they sort of play this way in which they try to seem to have the intellectual high ground, but what they're doing is just pillaging, you know, the Christian understanding of what God is.
Yeah, you're so right. So would you make much of a distinction between theistic evolutionists and secular evolutionists? I mean, what really sets them apart in the end?
They're metaphysical assumptions. What they assume to be the case before they do anything is the only difference. Functionally, they're going about their daily work as if they were atheists. I mean, you know, BioLogos kind of has this. Now, that doesn't say that they're not actively believing in God and praying at, you know, their church and things like that. But I mean, in terms of how they understand reality unfolding, they're looking for a naturalistic explanation for everything. They're not expecting to see God doing something. And so that allows them the freedom to basically enter, their lab to do biology from the perspective that the atheist enters with in the morning.
Good grief. So then if the theistic evolutionist goes by this idea that if we can explain it, God is unnecessary, and if we can't explain it today, we still shouldn't invoke God, then it seems that their God is science, and they just kind of attach the Bible to the end of it to maybe look a little bit better and excuse their views. I mean, it just seems like the Bible is not the authoritative source in the end in practical terms.
Right. And this gets back to sort of what they've sacrificed and how they continue to sacrifice. This isn't finished yet.
Yeah.
Right. And we haven't even sort of begun to talk about what it does to our understanding of ourselves in this world.
True.
With our origins and with the fall and all these wonderful things that all have to be reworked. They all have to be reworked. You have this sort of entire reworking of that framework, and the thing that keeps changing is going to be your interpretation of what God has revealed to us.
Yeah.
And what won't change is what the secular science has to report back to us.
Wow.
And I would say that if that were true, so sort of what happens is, I mentioned that this is a metaphysical assumption, they enter with the assumption of God. And this is a great concern to me, and I've actually talked with some of the folks at BioLogos about this, because it fits perfectly with something that Slate magazine said a couple months ago, which is basically places like BioLogos, this theistic evolution movement, is basically training wheels for atheism.
Oh, wow.
Because effectively what you'll do is you'll learn that you don't need God to explain anything. And so then he becomes superfluous. You just say, oh, I don't need that.
Yes.
And as Laplace once said, you know, I don't need that hypothesis, when he was talking to Napoleon. And so you sort of get this sort of this happening now, in which, and they're very overt about that. So if you go to the BioLogos website, you start looking through their BioLogos Basics material, there's a video there, and they talk about how, you know, they believe that God created the Hawaiian Islands, but they also think that a geologist's understanding of that is correct.
Hmm.
Which is to say, and this is what I've asked, is, okay, so if you're an atheist and you're a geologist, why would you go to say that God made anything?
True.
Why would you need God to explain the Hawaiian Islands? You don't.
No.
And Greg Kokel has a wonderful analogy for this. He often talks about this leprechaun.
Yeah, right.
So, you know,
he does.
Leprechaun and boiling water. If you ask a person, how do you boil water? And they tell you, well, you take it to sea level and you heat it to 100 degrees centigrade and then you add a leprechaun, it'll boil. and then they say, well, I don't have a leprechaun. And they say, well, it'll boil anyway.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the worldview. I don't think that's going to be appealing as an evangelical tool.
No.
You're not going to be able to evangelize and proselytize. You're not going to convince any atheist to go buying in. What you're going to try to do is save the Christian who's having doubts and tell them that there's a stopgap here.
Goodness.
That, you know, Darwin looks so bad on the surface, but yet there's this other path, so you don't have to give it up yet.
Right.
But I don't think that – I just don't believe that's going to be lasting. It's not going to be satisfying.
No. Well, do you see theistic evolution as a position that is gaining ground in the church or just kind of ignored? How do you see it playing out on the layman's level?
Yeah, well, that's the scary part, is it's being presented in this very superficial way that you can have your cake and eat too. You can have your God and your Darwin. And so in that sense, I get emails from pastors around the country, and I've even had a couple pastors writing me from Africa recently, talking about hearing this in youth study groups.
Oh, no.
On Sunday nights or Wednesday nights, and how this keeps coming up, and it dominates our academies.
Yeah.
And so that's how you change views. Michael Dowd has talked about this. Michael Dowd is an incredibly liberal theistic evolutionist. Says we're not going to get the older crowd; they're not going to change their view. But if we can get the children, and then they will teach their children, right? And so it becomes this wave, and it is. It's growing immensely. It dominates the academies, and it is showing up in our churches all over the place.
Right.
And it's sort of the assumed way now. I think this is, but we're doing this with other things. It's not just this. This is part of a larger, you know, honestly, a larger culture war in which we are becoming more tolerant, accepting, and then encouraging of things that would have traditionally been against the Christian views.
Absolutely. Just add it to the list. Well, and alluding to your title, Shadow of Oz, basically, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. There's nothing there.
Yep.
So,
yeah. And there isn't, and sort of the whole point of the shadow is that there's not even a man there. There's nothing back there.
Yeah.
Because, and this gets to, I mean, I don't want to get too far out in the weeds on this, but when you even start talking about the fundamental things, so in the beginning God created, right, you don't get a hard stance about the uniqueness of this universe anymore either. Now, there are some who vehemently defend the idea of fine-tuning and the universe is unique. But in general, what I'm seeing a lot more of is something like what Bruce Glass would hold, which is a much more flexible, well, maybe God created the universe, or maybe there is this other larger thing called the multiverse, and we'll just put God behind there. We'll just keep pushing him back and back and back.
Oh, boy.
And so there, as you just keep pulling back curtains, there's nobody there.
Yeah, that's really disturbing, as you say, because they're really intent upon making sure the younger kids start believing this, and then they can teach their kids. That's why it's really problematic, you know, this crazy.
And I think in pragmatic terms, if you're talking about just comparative religions, I mean, that's the other thing, is we can't assume that Christianity is the default.
Yeah, no, that's so true. Well, it's a great book. We are out of time, unfortunately. Okay. Shadow of Oz, Dr. Wayne Rossiter. Dr. Rossiter, great job on the book. Great to have had you here. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, you take care. We'll be back. Have you ever come home from work to find the power is out? The power company informs you that they expect repairs to take another 8 hours, leaving you and your family in the dark for a frighteningly long time. Panic begins to set in. What are you going to do? Of course, you've been told to prepare for this. Bottled water, radio, flashlights, plenty of fresh batteries, easy to prepare meals. For the next 8 hours, everyone is on edge with no AC, no TV, and certainly no hot dinner tonight. What if this same situation were to last 2 days, a week, or even a few months? This is Janet Mefford, here to tell you about the peace of mind that is offered by Heaven's Harvest. Heaven's Harvest has the long-term storable food and water solutions that will ensure the well-being of your family during any man-made or natural disaster. Don't wait for the power to go out. Go to heavensharvest.com or call 800-516-4773. That's 800-516-4773 or heavensharvest.com. Be sure to use the promo code Janet for free shipping. That's heavensharvest.com. We are back on Janet Mefford today. I am going to spend some time playing you some audio from a video that I watched. And this is just one of the most incredible things I think I've watched in a long, long time. The Weekly Standard reported on this. A division of the Department of Justice has put out this instructional video for police officers across the country on how to interact with transgenders. Instructional video. It's called Law Enforcement and the Transgender Community. It runs just under 13 minutes, and it focuses on the subject of teaching cops the approved terminology with those they believe are transgendered citizens. And let me tell you, it is something else. Let's just put it that way. Something else. You have to hear what this video contains to really see the full impact. So first, they reenact in this video the right way for a police officer to deal with a man in a blonde wig behind the wheel of a pulled over car. In other words, there's this transgendered, you know, man in a wig who thinks he's a woman. He's driving a car. He has a problem with the car, and the police officer pulls him over. And then the police officer narrator then weighs in on how the cop did. So let's listen to cut one.
Driver's license and registration, please.
Yes, officer.
Is this your most current identification?
Yes, it is. It needs to be updated.
Do you prefer if I call you ma'am or sir?
Ma'am, please.
Ma'am, do you know why I stopped you here today?
No, officer.
The reason I stopped you is you have a taillight out on the right side.
Oh.
Wait right here while I verify your information.
Yes, officer.
Hey, I don't have to be in the room with you to know what probably just happened. Somebody just snickered, laughed, or made a joke. Trust me, I know. I'm a cop, too. As police officers, we use humor to deal with things that make us uncomfortable or afraid. Now, the previous scenario demonstrated a common way that many police officers come into contact with members of the transgender community. That officer handled it perfectly.
Okay, so in other words, if you're a police officer and you're sitting in some instructional room and you're made to watch this video and you laughed or you snickered or you had some sort of response to the video that was not the acceptable Department of Justice way, it's because you're uncomfortable or afraid. He just told you, you know, we all laugh when we're uncomfortable or afraid, but never really delves into the idea of whether or not uncomfortable might be a normal reaction to seeing a man behind the wheel of a car in a wig for a woman and calling himself ma'am when he's got this deep voice, or saying my driver's license needs to be updated. Yeah, you're wrong, police officer. If you have anything other than a completely, great reaction to this reality, then the problem's on you. So then the narrator goes on to explain the ridiculous leftist invented terms assigned sex, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Now, keep in mind, this report that we were just telling you about recently coming out, the 143 pages of peer-reviewed article research that was done by Dr. Paul McHugh and some of these Johns Hopkins experts, revealing that sexual orientation and gender identity are basically meaningless terminology. We'll put that aside for a while. That's the reality. But this is the Department of Justice's take on this. Listen to cut two.
Let's start with some basics. Terminology. We need to take a closer look at three basic terms and the distinct differences between how we define them. They are assigned sex, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Assigned sex is also known as birth sex. It refers to the biological or physiological designation as male or female at birth, usually based on anatomy. Transgender individuals are people whose internal feelings of being male or female are not consistent with their assigned sex. Now, it's estimated that about 700,000 transgender individuals live in the United States. They can be found in every walk of life, including law enforcement. Sexual orientation refers to a person's physical and/or emotional attraction to people of a specific gender. It refers to who someone loves, feels attracted to, or with whom they desire to have an intimate relationship. Heterosexual, bisexual, gay, or lesbian are all types of sexual orientation.
Well, I feel educated. I don't know about you. Why is the Department of Justice this kind engaging in this sort of stuff? We have to make sure that all the police officers in America get on board the LGBT agenda. And let me tell you how it is. Assigned sex, that is a ridiculous phrase, assigned sex. You're male or you're female. Forget the hermaphrodite population, which is infinitesimally small. You're male or female. You don't, and you could also observe, if you have the term assigned sex, who assigned you the sex? Oh, wait a minute. We don't want to get into that. Sexual orientation or gender identity. It's incredible, the social justice warrior mentality of this administration. I also want to know how much money was spent in taxpayer dollars to put this thing together. Anyway, the narrator goes on to say, you really need to get the phrase transgender right. Cut three.
Lastly, the term trans is often used by some as shorthand to refer to transgender individuals or, by and large, the transgender community. While it may be acceptable to some, the safest term to use is the entire word transgender. When in doubt, it's always best to ask an individual what their preference is. Just simply ask, how would you like to be addressed?
And this gets back to what you heard earlier in that first reenactment. Do you want to be called ma'am or sir? And I thought it was interesting that in that scenario, the answer was, well, I know what my ID says, but it needs to be updated. And that's perfectly fine. What is the purpose of an ID if who you are doesn't match your ID? Could the rest of us get away with that in real life? Well, I know that my ID says a different name or a different sex or whatever, but that's not really me. And the cop has to go, oh, okay. It seems to me that's awfully confusing, but I guess it's not politically correct to question it. All right. So then he says, basically, don't worry about the person not matching his or her ID. It's not a problem if you're a police officer. Cut four.
When someone's name or gender on a license is different from what you expect, how do you react? Is this person committing identity theft? Are they a fugitive? Possibly they're just transgender. Officer safety always comes first. But as long as I can tell it's the same person on a photo ID, I don't get distracted. I just focus on the task in front of me and on courtesy and respect. And if you're not certain what the proper way to address someone is, just ask.
All right. I have a problem with this. I'm not a police officer. I don't know all the rules in and out, but it seems to me to be a massive problem and there are massive implications from telling police officers if the name or the gender on the ID are different from what they actually are, it's different from what you expect is what they actually said there, then, you know, you're the problem. You just need to figure out how to ask questions and don't worry about it. Should you not worry about it if somebody's name or gender is not the same as what they are in reality? Do you think the rest of us, again, could the rest of us get away with this? I know my ID says this, but I'm actually the opposite. Well, just don't get distracted. Just ask if he wants to be called ma'am or sir. This is a recipe for chaos. That's all I can say. It's a recipe for chaos. So I want to play for you another reenactment. This is an interesting one. A man dressed as a woman reports getting hurt feelings walking around in his neighborhood. I guess he had some incident in the neighborhood. And one of the police officers makes the mistake of calling the man sir. And the other police officer chastises him and he properly repents. You got to listen to this one. It's cut five.
I'm Corporal Burks. This is Officer Salvestrini.
Hi, sir. Hi, ma'am.
What can we help you with today?
Well, I was walking down the block and I noticed a man not too far behind me. After a few blocks, I noticed he was following me. He started yelling things, just words that I really don't want to repeat. It's just, I really don't feel safe walking in my neighborhood.
Sir, what were you doing?
Can you excuse us for a moment? Just step up here for a minute. Sal, what are you doing? Don't let the fact that she's transgender throw you off, okay? Show her the respect that she deserves.
You're right. I'm sorry.
Okay, so let's show her that we're a professional agency and we'll go back out there and we'll start from the beginning.
Okay.
All right, go on.
I want to apologize about before. How would you like me to address you, sir or ma'am?
Well, thank you for asking, and ma'am will be fine.
Ma'am? Great. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
I'm just speechless by this one. So the cop is wrong because the cop addresses a man as sir. And so gets hauled off into the next room by the other police officer, who chastises him for calling a man sir. And you better get your act together. And then he, you know, puts his tail between his legs and returns to the... Listen, I'm not saying that police officers should be openly rude to anybody or openly hostile to anybody. I get that. I'm on board with that. But what you're really doing is you're using this narrative to make people accept what is not true. You know, there was a time when people understood, and a lot of doctors and psychiatrists, such as Dr. Paul McHugh, still understand that transgenderism, this gender dysphoria, is a form of mental illness. They feel different than what they really are. And that is something that needs treatment, not affirmation. You don't have to be mean or rude to anybody, but neither do you have to participate in that sort of fiction. And yet this is what your Obama administration is up to. We'll be coming back on Janet Mefford Today. So you've missed the healthcare deadline and don't have any form of healthcare? Liberty HealthShare has the answer. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry that offers an affordable healthcare option, allowing you to enroll any time of the year. Liberty HealthShare allows you to control, manage, and direct your healthcare, yet still be in good standing with the Affordable Care Act. Members are exempt from the tax penalty and mandates imposed on individuals for not having healthcare insurance, thus giving you freedom from insurance. Liberty HealthShare gives you the ability to choose any doctor or hospital across the nation. Memberships are for individuals, couples, and families, offering a variety of options to best suit your medical needs. If you're a freedom-loving American looking for contract-free health care, then Liberty Health Share is for you. For more information on how to enroll at any time of the year, call now, 855-585-4237. That's 855-585-4237. Or visit libertyhealthshare.org to request a free estimate. That's libertyhealthshare.org.
The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Hello, I'm Tony Perkins with the Family Research Council in Washington. At one after-school program, the devil is in the details. In what sounds more like a Saturday Night Live skit than real life, the Satanic Temple is making headlines for rolling out a new after-school club for elementary kids, Educating with Satan. The curriculum, which is apparently being considered in 10 states, is the temple's way of protesting the good news clubs of evangelicals. Quote, "We have a general philosophy of inclusiveness," said a spokesman. "This is a non-religious zone," end quote. Thanks to a 2001 Supreme Court ruling, the temple is just as welcome to organize after school as Christians. And I'll have to hand it to them, if this is a publicity stunt, it's succeeding. But while the devil always puts on a good show, he and his followers can't offer the life-changing power found in the good news of Jesus Christ. Let's make sure we share that news. For more, go to TonyPerkins.com.
We are back on Janet Mefford Today. I am spending a little bit of time on this Department of Justice video that's just come out telling police officers how to deal with transgendered individuals and asking them whether or not they prefer the term ma'am or sir. And don't worry about whether or not the name or the gender on the ID don't match who the person really is. You need to just get over that and put your tail between your legs. And if you refer to a man as sir, but he wants to be known as a woman, then the problem's on you. The federal government is now telling cops how they have to act and how they have to deal with something that isn't true. That's my objection. It isn't that you shouldn't be kind and respectful and professional with every single person with whom you have to do on the beat. I agree with that completely. I don't think you should go out of your way to be nasty to anybody. But on the other hand, for police officers to be, you know, put into this political correctness straitjacket where they can't think for themselves, I'm sorry, but that's exactly what this video is advocating. You can't think for yourself. You have to just push it down. There's nothing wrong. Everything is just fine. So I want to play for you just a couple of quick more cuts. There was another reenactment in this video, and here's the situation. I'll set it up. There are two people talking at a table, presumably at a college, and one of them is a transgender. It's a man in a dress, clearly a man in a dress, who gets up from the conversation, goes into the ladies' room, and then another woman sees this happen, and she calls the police and says, "I'm concerned because I saw a man go into the ladies' room, and I'm just a little nervous about this." The police officer then comes to the situation and deals with it. So just listen to how this plays out. This is cut 7.
All right, we'll have to use the restroom, okay? I'll be right back. Yes, hi. I'd like to make a report of what I think was a man in the ladies' bathroom.
I'm back.
Sorry, just finishing up an outline for a paper.
That's okay. What time is your next class?
I have until 3:30.
Oh, cool.
Did you call the police?
I did. I think I saw a man walk into the ladies' bathroom, and I don't know what he's doing there.
Other than being in the restroom, did the individual do anything to raise your concerns?
Nah, I just don't think he belongs there, and it's making me nervous.
Excuse me. Do you have a minute?
Yes, I do.
Hi, I'm Corporal Dazzy with the Prince George's County Police Department, and the reason I'm here is because we got a complaint in regards to a gentleman using the wrong restroom. Were you in the restroom?
Yes, officer, but I'm a woman. I was just in there using the restroom.
Was there anyone else in the restroom?
No, I was in there alone.
Officer, we're just having lunch.
Again, I'm sorry for the inconvenience. I apologize. Probably a misunderstanding. You both have a great day.
Thank you.
All right, so you listen to this reenactment. Forget the forced acting, which is part of the comedy of it all, is just how bad the acting is. But here again, the man says to the police officer, I'm a woman. I was, and you're looking at a man who's dressed as a woman, and you're supposed to just, oh, he's a woman. You are telling people to believe something that is fictitious. You are trying to get all of society to go along with something that isn't true. He's not a man. He's a man who wants to be a woman, who's dressed as a woman. That doesn't make him a woman. And what does it mean to be male or female if anybody, just by declaring themselves to be something, is all of a sudden regarded by society as what they proclaim rather than what they really are? How do you run a society when you can't even objectively identify reality anymore? And this is what the left wants us to do. This is insanity. This is crazy. And I can't believe that there are not more people on the left who actually object to this and say, wait a minute, come on. I mean, really? Really? This is not the solution. This is not what we ought to be doing. So at the very end, I think that this cut I'm going to play for you, this last cut, from this DOJ video training police officers across the country on how to deal with transgendered individuals, really says more about their agenda than I could possibly say. Here's cut 8.
If your department does not have a policy on issues like communicating with or searching transgender individuals, you may want to consider developing one with the help of community organizations. Transgender people are just trying to be their true selves and live their lives as members of our communities, just like anyone else.
But they're not their true selves. That's the whole point. They're not their true selves. And they make that point throughout the video. They're just like anybody else. Well, if they were just like everybody else, there wouldn't be any need for an instructional video. Now, would there? I mean, you're, again, critical thinking skills come into play here. It is not a matter of being nasty to anybody, but for crying out loud, when you have people who have gender dysphoria, you don't affirm it. You recognize that the person has confusion and has some mental issues and needs to have that dealt with. And why there's no compassion on these poor people who really do need that help, I don't know. But it does help the leftist agenda of being able to upend the binary of male and female. And we as Christians continually have to stand against this, because it's not just a matter of whether or not you believe the Bible and if you are saved, which is the most important thing, but it's also having a grip on reality and whether or not you're going to be affirming reality or if you're going to be denying reality because it's more suitable to your politics. That's what's going on here. And it's, I don't know. I don't know how this is going to play out across the country, but I definitely think that the overemphasis on this issue by this administration will be its greatest lasting legacy. That Obama was, you know, he couldn't be bothered to go to Louisiana for the hundreds of thousands of people who lost their homes in those floods, but he sure was quick with the rainbow lights the day the Obergefell decision was handed down. So he picks and chooses what he thinks is an important issue and is worthy of his crowning as a great achievement by the executive branch of the United States government. And you know what? That's not a legacy that I think in the long run the people of history are going to affirm. I just don't think it's going to happen. Along those lines, this is very interesting. This week, there is a group called Campus Pride. It's a college LGBT advocacy group, and it released what it calls its shame list. Don't you like that? This is from Campus Fix, I believe, or College Fix. Sorry. It features 102 religious colleges that have requested Title IX waivers from the federal government to openly discriminate against LGBTQ youth or both. Executive Director Shane Windmeyer said in a post on the list's release that these schools use religion as a tool for cowardice and discrimination against non-straight youth. Or in other words, they want to stand up for biblical sexual morality. started in December to highlight schools that had requested or obtained Title IX waivers, information that has since been made public by the Department of Education. The list has expanded to include schools that have not asked the feds for waivers. Two of the schools, in fact, show up on the list solely because they featured ex-lesbians in chapel services. Wheaton College invited Rosaria Butterfield, the former Syracuse University professor, to speak on her self-described train wreck conversion from leftist lesbian to heterosexual Christian. And if you've read her book, as I have, very fascinating story of how she became a Christian and now is married to a pastor. Grove City College, one of the few colleges in America to refuse federal money, found itself shamed solely for featuring Kristen Johnson, executive director of the One by One ex-gay ministry at a chapel in 2008. Most of the other listed schools that did not request waivers are in California. They gave money to the campaign against a far-reaching state anti-discrimination bill, SB 1146. This was the horrible bill that is now kind of on hiatus for the moment. I'm sure it's going to come roaring back. That would punish them for enforcing sexual lifestyle expectations. The non-waiver California schools are Westmont College, Vanguard University, Trinity Law School, Point Loma Nazarene University, Life Pacific College, Concordia University, California Baptist University, and Azusa Pacific University. The nation's first accredited Muslim college, California's Zaytuna, is not on the list, perhaps because President Hamza Yusuf Hansen personally signed a letter against SB 1146. Muslim student groups were also exempt from California State University's all-comers policy because they didn't put their faith requirements for leaders in writing, as Christian groups did. Very interesting. So this is the next horizon. This is what they're after next. When you talk about where the LGBT agenda is headed, this is where they're headed. What they want to do is not only expose Christian colleges and universities that would stand up for biblical sexual morality and actually have codes, which Christian schools have always had, of profession of belief and code of conduct and all these sorts of things, and expose them as bigots. And basically what they would like to do in a series of laws that are proposed is take away the whole concept of religious exemption. That's what they want gone. This is where they're headed. And if you read their websites and if you read their material, this is where a lot of these activists are. They think it is discriminatory for any Christian to have any moral objection whatsoever to homosexuality, period. And because they don't like it, they want to make it against the law, or they want to expose you, and they want to come up with shame lists, and they want to kick you and verbally for doing what you're doing. This is a far cry from the whole emphasis on the United States concept of individual liberty, individual freedom, our First Amendment protections under the Constitution, that we have the right to our religious consciences. We have the right to believe what we want to believe about God's word, and we have the right to believe what we want to believe about whether or not you should have kids on campus, on a Christian campus, who are engaging in homosexual behavior. You have the right as a Christian college to not hold that up as normative or acceptable behavior. You're a Christian college and you adhere to the Bible and you have the right to do that. But this, unfortunately, is yet another battleground with the LGBT agenda because they don't like you ever having any alternate opinion on this issue whatsoever. Something to keep in mind and to pray about. Well, we thank you for joining us here on Janet Mefford today. Always a pleasure. We'll see you next time. Take care and God bless.